Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 7th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Approaching Jesus' Ethical Teachings, Session 1 of The Ethics of Jesus, presented by Jim Hansen, number HAJ 2003-01. Let's listen in.
How's that?
Good.
That's good.
Now we're being recorded, so everybody be good. My name is Jim Hansen. You can call me the Reverend Dr. James Hansen. I should introduce a bit of formality to this place. It's just a little too laid back for me. No. The Reverend wouldn't be right anyway, but I'm not ordained. And you'll see why probably as we progress. I am, in case you didn't read my bio, which I encourage you to do. There's no picture there, though, because it turned out so I think it broke the camera. But it was after a hike, and you don't want to look like after a hike. But I teach at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. And this is a couple of firsts for me. I teach in the religion department. My main area of work is in early Christianity, the New Testament. But I also do some, partly because of that, I do some work in Jewish-Christian dialogue. But mostly my interest is in the Gospels and Paul. They tell me there are other books in the New Testament, but I haven't looked at them yet. The title of my sessions this week are the ethics of is the ethics of Jesus. And I must say, I found it kind of interesting to see the reaction I get when I tell people that's what I'm teaching. I wasn't prepared. I thought, you know, it seems like a natural thing. But even as I was coming out here, what are you teaching? The ethics of Jesus. Huh. And when I told people here, too, I don't see anybody. They laughed after they heard about it. When I'd say the ethics of Jesus, I would get kind of just a moment hesitation. I feel that was kind of an odd thing. And I guess I'd like to just start off, I genuinely want to know, this isn't like some teaching 101 technique, but why do you think that would be? Why does that seem like an odd, or maybe it doesn't to you, and that's why you're here, but what might be kind of odd about that title? I'm genuinely surprised.
Lutherans associate ethics with works, and we associate Jesus with faith, and be careful with works,
right.
And righteousness.
Yeah.
And so you don't think of Christ as an ethical person.
Yeah, for Lutherans and Protestants, and by the way, I don't assume that that's what you all are, so if you're all of a sudden saying, wait a minute, I'm not a Lutheran, that's fine. I hope you're not a Lutheran, or even Protestant, or even human. But absolutely, for Protestants, it's like, well, isn't that stuff just supposed to make us feel bad so that we and you know, it's not something that as Protestants, if that's the tradition we were raised in, we probably spent a lot of time thinking about. Yeah.
Well, you think about Jesus and ethical behavior, it's a duh.
Yeah.
It's a given, so how can you spend time talking about it? It's a given.
Right, right. So there's something almost redundant about it, right, and repetitive and superfluous.
I wouldn't say that. Redundant, yes.
No, but redundant in the sense that, wait a minute, the ethics of Jesus, well, Jesus is ethics, isn't he? So, I mean, you know, right. So, but the idea that Jesus possessed an ethic is maybe part of the strange, part of this, because isn't he the very definition of ethics?
Yeah, maybe a part of it for me is that when you think of the ethics of Jesus, you would think Jesus is perfect, so he always knew the perfect ethical decision.
Right.
And yet, he sometimes fought and sometimes he ran.
Yeah.
So that it gets frustrating.
Right. Anything else? Any other way the title strikes you?
I'm kind of hoping for something a little more complex than what would Jesus do?
Yeah. Well, you better. have you been to whole night recently? I brought bracelets for everyone. I figured it wouldn't be long before that would come in. Yeah, it is. I mean, kind of a funny thing, and I hadn't really thought about it. But the fact that I think a couple things. Anything else? I just wanna, because that it's caused me to reflect on it.
I think a little bit is because we really love thinking about what Jesus does for us and has done for us, and how we feel about what Jesus has done for us, and we just feel so good. And ethics sounds like college,
right?
Checklists.
Yeah. Ethics does. The word ethics is kind of a downer word. It's not an exciting word. But yeah, the idea that wait a minute, there might be something involved here more than just Jesus loves me. that might be some demand to us and a challenge to us. Yeah, that's I know for me personally, it's one of the reasons. Well, I'll talk more about myself later. But, in fact, the second half is pretty much different. As soon as we get past this question.
The idea for me was that Jesus might have had an agenda.
Yeah, right. And what kind of agenda? What would surprise you about that?
That he was really had some ethics that he wanted to get across, not just Jesus loves me to do and God is good and all that good stuff.
But Jesus had a program that he wanted to enact in the here and now. I think that's a big thing. I mean, what is the most famous summary of the Christian faith out of the Bible? The most famous verse out of the John 3:16.
What is it again?
16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, and whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. Well, that's exactly, you know, what Dennis was talking about and what you're suggesting. Hey, wait a minute, you know. He died. We're going to see that the cross is going to become sort of the linchpin between. I mean, the other piece that kind of gets at both of these is at the end of at least the Lutheran liturgy, and I don't know how far back this goes or where exactly it came from, but you say you gave your son as a sacrifice for sin and a model of the godly life. And it's kind of like, well, the sacrifice for sin part is the part that we hear most about, especially, you know. Well, I shouldn't, again, I don't want to presume things. If some of you have different experiences, if you grew up, you know, with the Sermon on the Mount as your guide, I want to hear from you, and I want to hear what that was like for you, because for me that wasn't the case, and for a lot of Protestants, it wasn't the case. So, I mean, that's what we're that's what we're after here.
I had to do this last time. Go way down, and then it goes.
Teamwork.
Ta-da! Somebody erased it. I had a. Actually, because it was such a weird topic, I decided instead to do the ethics of Homer Simpson. So that's which might actually be more interesting.
I go get my kiss.
That would be closer to home, I think, for some of us. But we won't go there right now. The basic question that we want to ask, though, and as strange as it may be, is to ask, what did Jesus teach? I mean, especially about ethics, about what we should do with our lives. And what role should that play, should what Jesus taught play in our lives as Christians? So those are two separate questions. What did Jesus actually teach? And by teach, I don't want to say, because he taught, of course, through more than just his words. He also taught through his actions, and we'll be looking at those two. And what role should that play? Should what Jesus taught, what role should that play for us today? I mean, what difference does it make? And today we just want to get kind of open up these two questions. And then as the week progresses, those of you who decide to stay with us, we'll be looking at some particular issue. Let me just say a couple things about myself. This is new for me in two ways. First of all, I've never been to Holden. I've heard about it all my life, and it was so great that I had a chance, thanks to Maureen and Christine, to come here. And I have to say, it's everything I heard it would be and more. The wow factor. My daughter just makes fun of me because all I do is go around and say wow, wow. And I was assured I would feel the same way about the people here too, and I have so far. So this is really great. But also the subject matter, even though I've, you know, looking at Jesus, and especially at his so-called historical Jesus, which we'll talk about just a little bit, was the thing that got me interested in New Testament studies way back in college. And but for me, it was really an intellectual thing. How can Jesus be? How can this guy from Nazareth in Galilee be the savior of the world? You know, and the more you learn about him from a historical perspective, the more urgent that question became for me. So I went to seminary did get certified for ordination, but I decided in part because I still had these questions about these intellectual questions. Well, as the years have gone by, as they do, I've realized the intellectual part of it is probably, well, I wouldn't minimize it, but the intellectual part of it is really the easy part. I mean, who hasn't had questions about, you know, how could this be? as I become, you know, ensconced in middle-aged, middle-class life, it's more the question of, well, what the real stumbling block to sort of fully embracing Christian faith is more, well, what does it demand of me? And what is it, I'd studied Jesus enough to realize that if I were going to fully embrace what he taught, I didn't think I could live the life that I lived, the life of a middle-class American. and so there is this, and that's part of this discomfort factor when you hear the ethics of Jesus. Oh, yikes. If I remember correctly, when we breezed through the Sermon on the Mount or whatever in Sunday school, he said some things that were pretty radical and pretty difficult to swallow, difficult to reconcile with, I mean, I don't need to beat this, beat a dead horse, but with middle-class American life. So I've been avoiding it. I would have to say, I've been avoiding the topic of fully examining Jesus' ethical teachings. I usually do, you know, a unit on it. a couple days on when we talk about the Gospels. But like a good, like most good Lutherans, for me the Gospel is getting up every Sunday morning and saying, we confess that we are in bondage to sin and we cannot free ourselves. That's my favorite. But these words are so dramatic that we say in this confession. And yet, of course, we all say them. We are in bondage to sin and cannot free ourselves. We have sinned to God. You know, we have not loved our neighbor as ourselves. But, you know, of course, the other one is, I've never had to do this because I've not been in parish, but I've always felt sorry for the pastor on Easter Sunday morning at a big Lutheran congregation comes out and says, Christ is risen! He is risen indeed. he's got to hear the word, he is risen indeed. Hallelujah. Like, Lutherans are much better at the Good Friday thing than the Easter thing. Go to somewhere else. Go to the Baptist church for Easter Sunday. But anyway, the point is, built into the very rhythm of our lives is this realization that we're gonna show up on Sunday and confess that we couldn't do all these things. That's kind of the centerpiece, is that, oh, I failed again. One of the things we want to look at is, well, what does that do to the whole aspect of sort of the imitation of Christ, the word which Luther did not like at all, but not surprisingly. So for me, it's not so much the intellectual challenge anymore. I figured it all out. and if you want to know how it all fits together, you can come on and show 8:13. But that's not my subject for this week. The real issue, John Howard Euler is someone I'm sure some of you have read, and I'll be referring to him a lot over the course of the week. But he has a great quote, and a very for me personally, sort of challenging quote. The real issue, he says, is not whether Jesus can make sense in a world far from Galilee, which is the intellectual question, but whether, when he meets us in our world, as he does, in fact, we want to follow him. That's, I don't presume that that's where you all are, but I'm kind of coming from where I am, assuming that I may not be alone in this. We come to our questions. What did Jesus teach, and what role should this play for us? Two different kinds of questions, right? One is, what you might call a description. Part of our task is going to simply be, obviously in a few sessions we can only scratch the surface, although the issues we're going to be covering are pretty big ones, and they should, you know, they should be fun to look at. But a description of what Jesus actually taught. That's obviously the first step. We've got to know, what did he teach about violence and nonviolence? What did he teach about marriage and divorce? The other question is what, you know, in technical terms, you might call normative questions. What role should that play? To what extent should what Jesus taught be a source or the source for our ethical decisions, for our ethical behavior? I mean, should all Christians be pacifists? Because Jesus, first we have to determine, was Jesus truly pacifist? Was nonviolence his only prescription for it? And second, if that was the case, what difference should that make for us? That kind of a thing. And if Jesus did absolutely forbid divorce, what difference should that make for us? So it's a two-step process, which you make a distinction like this, of course, recognizing that that it is artificial. That is to say, it's hard to do the description. It's possible to describe it objectively. You'll see scholars disagreeing about what Jesus said about this, coming to different conclusions. And we'll see in a minute why that might be the case. So it's not as though this is some objective thing. But we'll do our best to sort of push away some of our presuppositions. And some of us certainly would, our own interests would be that, well, did Jesus leave a little room for divorce? Or am I totally damned for all time because of it? So we don't come to these questions in a disinterested way, and we have to be aware of that and be honest. And then we ask more explicitly, what should we then do? It's sort of like the question Jesus asked the lawyer who came up to him and said, do you need a good lawyer? I don't think that's what he said. He said, how should I inherit eternal life? And Jesus said, well, what is in the text? How do you read? What is in the, it's sort of two questions. What is in the text? That's the descriptive part. And how do you read it? How do you apply it to yourself? It's sort of those same kinds of questions. And it's also like Jesus' question to his disciples. Who do people say that I am? It's a descriptive question. What's out there? How are people describing me? But who do you say that I am? That is to say, what is your disposition towards me? Is a normative question. How am I going to function in your life? So what we want to do here for the rest of the morning, really, is to look at some of the issues involved with asking each of these questions. Not so much to look at any particular issues alone, we'll be looking at some examples. But to be aware of some of the problems, I was going to say, some of the problems that can cause you to spend decades avoiding the second question. That is to say, we'll see that there are all kinds of interesting historical and literary questions about what Jesus actually did taught that can sort of prevent you. You can get hung up on those. Well, we won't do that, and I challenge you to make sure that I don't spend the rest of the week talking about, well, so-and-so says this. And we do get to the second question. But so what's involved in figuring out, like somebody said, well, Jesus is ethics, so everything he did must be ethical. The fact is, and some of this is going to be, I know, stuff that many of you have heard before, so forgive me if I seem too remedial, but the first thing to recognize, of course, the first question that comes up in this first question, the first question about this first question is, which Jesus, right? That is to say, the gospel, the New Testament, we were talking about this morning in Jonathan's Bible study about the creation story. It's an amazing, the New Testament authors did not give us just one portrait of Jesus. How many of you knew that? How many of you can name all, no, all five? How many of you can name all five of them? The New Testament authors gave us four very distinct versions of Jesus' life. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It's kind of an amazing thing when you think about it that they rejected the possibility of disharmonizing it all into one, but left the four in with all their contradictions. Just like the creation story, there are two of those, and instead of harmonizing them into one, they pretty much left, you know, any careful reader will see that these are two different things and that have some contradictions. But my favorite way to illustrate just the distinctiveness, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. My favorite way is to get up on a fireplace. my favorite scene, this is not particularly, this does not have directly to do with ethics, although, as we'll see either today or tomorrow, depending on where we get, that this is the death scene. Which I'll come, I can just enact. I don't know, it'd be interesting to have the text projected on the first one, so that would be an interesting piece of art. This is obviously a complicated scene, and I only want to point out a couple things about it. This is the death of Jesus. I hope I'm not giving anything away by saying that he does. I'm sorry. Is there another? Yes, there are. There are a couple other endings. In fact, speaking of the Quran has another ending to that story. We were talking about the Quran this morning. In the Quran, Jesus doesn't die. I'm not just talking about the Last Temptation of Christ. Story. Anyway, just all this is to say is that is to show that the Gospels each have a very distinctive portrait of Jesus. On no less a thing than his death. And as I said, I think the death of Jesus, or the cross of Christ, however you want to put it, is going to be a really important linchpin between that Jesus as a sacrifice for sin and a model of the godly life, as we'll see. So I think this will pay off. But just briefly, how many of you have seen a synopsis like this before? With all four Gospels, and sometimes just the first three. Well, it comes from... There's a book, there's several versions of this, where you can look at the Gospels in parallel, and it's very handy. Of course, there are also sites on the web. I can give you a really great website where you can scroll down in each and then click a little thing that'll bring up that parallel passage. And, there's some great web resources, too. But Gospel Parallels, there's a new version of this that has this is the Revised Standard Version. There's one with the new Revised Standard Version. What are they going to call the next one?
All new Revised
Standard Version. The Revised New Revised Standard Version is the one that RNRSV. That's going to be, and Jesus was like, you know. Jesus was like, my God, my God. And the disciples were all, I'm on the committee for that. We're trying to work out the Greek word for so here we are, you know, laughing hysterically, and we've got, this is almost like a Monty Python thing. We've got the death of Jesus on the screen here. Just again, I don't want to get into detail, but what you can see is the commonality. Jesus dies on all four, obviously. That is a piece that each gospel writer had to deal with. And I know it's vague to even kind of get your mind around, isn't it? Maybe I should.
Let me slide it up.
Yeah, maybe a little. Oh, I see. I thought you meant move the whole machine up, but I think we need the top. There we go. I also didn't bring my laser pointer, which I've been using as a cat toy. If you've ever tried that, your cat will just go nuts. It's really fun. But pretend I'm pointing at the first. I divided them into scenes. Actually, there are four scenes, and the horizontal lines are mine. So this is the all four Gospels side by side. You can see, first of all, similarities between Matthew and Mark. Matthew and Mark are probably the closest for me to say, because Matthew, Mark. But what are the, if you've had a chance just to look, what are some of the differences that you see Well, similarities and or differences. I know some of your kids do that very well. Well, it's not, yeah, see, this is hard. They're down here. He doesn't say
scene.
This. Right, in that scene.
In that
right,
scene.
Yes, in that scene. He does not say, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, Norwegian for something, I'm not sure.
The last words are different.
Yes, the last words are different. Yeah. I mean, in Matthew and Mark, he says what? As the very last intelligible thing.
Why have you forsaken me?
Why have you forsaken me? My God, why have you forsaken me? Whereas in Luke, he says what? Can you read that?
Into
your hands I commit my spirit. And in John, he says, it's finished. This is supposedly, this is the last word that Jesus spoke. Very different character. I mean, how would you describe, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Angry.
Yeah.
Despair.
Angry, despairing. Yeah, I mean, and what about Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit?
He's trusting.
Yeah, trusting. Yeah. I mean, if you think of this as abandonment or almost betrayal as a word that someone used once there, like why have you, this sense of betrayal, this sense of disconnection between God and Jesus, that God has left Jesus hanging literally, and here there's a real sense of connection. I commit my hands into your spirit. It's very obviously. And then in John, it's hard to get a sense of what's going on in John because John is of course, the maverick gospel. Like this gospel parallels book only has the first three. The first three gospels, as some of you should know, are called the synoptic gospels because there's so much of them that can be profitably read together, whereas John is the one who really goes his own way. And in a synopsis of all four, you'll have long periods where John is in just blank space in the John column. But it is finished here. Most of you have read the Gospel of John. How would you describe what does that evoke? If this evokes despair, betrayal, if this evokes trust, connection.
Control, accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Control.
Job completed.
Yep. Task completed, a sense of satisfaction, I guess, to use a loaded theological phrase. Anything else?
Obedience.
Yeah, obedience. Yeah. I mean, the idea if you read, it's a great way to read the Gospels is to start from this point and just say, well, how does this scene sort of form the climax? I mean, how is this an appropriate way to tell the story of Jesus' death in light of the Gospels? Jesus as a whole. For John, Jesus from the very beginning, he's actually one with God, right? So it wouldn't make any sense for Jesus to be split apart from God. He never questions God's will, even, and there's no Gethsemane scene in John. There's no praying. In fact, Jesus even says, Father, what should I say? Save me from this hour? No. it's almost a direct rebuttal. It's found that a very interesting scene. John. I'm not going to pray that because the Father's will and my will are the same in John. Mark is probably the most different from John in that Jesus even says at one point when Jesus is very much not God in Mark, in any sort of, certainly not in the Johannine sense. Johannine. That's why I became a New Testament scholar, so I can say Johannine. the adjective of John. Certainly not in John's sense of Jesus being one with the Father. In fact, there's the scene that we'll look at in just a minute where Mark's in Mark when the rich young ruler that's like linked by that too, the pilot character, if you've seen The Life of Brian. Ruiz Waterwick. Pilate has a speaking pattern in The Life of Brian. It's one of the funniest scenes. And the crowd all cries out, who should I release for you? And the crowd all calls out names of ours in because they want to. Roderick! And they all laugh. Ruiz, is there a Waterwick? Then
that the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and says, "Good teacher, why do you? Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says, "Remember what he says.
Why
do you call me good? No one is good but God alone." I mean, just drawing a very clear distinction between himself and God. And so there's a very big difference there. And that, again, that Jesus is a human being with a will of his own. Remember what he prays in Gethsemane. Not my will, but your will. My will is different from yours, but I submit mine to yours. In John, Jesus' will and God and God's are the same will. In Mark, it's perfectly appropriate. Jesus, from the very beginning, is misunderstood. He's mysterious. He's enigmatic. What's really interesting, even though Matthew and Mark are, I don't want to get bogged down in the scene because it's just supposed to be illustrative. Illustrative. This is the most unique teaching position I've ever had.
I've got a new teaching position. Oh, yeah?
It's up on the fireplace. We should have reenacted the sacrifice of Isaac here. What's really interesting is what happens when Jesus dies, actually in the first three Gospels. So if you look at Mark, who was probably, as you probably know, the first Gospel, the curtain of the temple was torn in two. So Jesus utters a loud cry and breathes his last. Some unintelligible cry. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And then you skip to scene four. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that he thus breathed his last, he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God." And if you've ever seen him, the greatest story ever told. Remember who does that line?
John Wayne.
John Wayne. Just can't get that out of my mind whenever, you know, they zoom in on him. Apparently he was drunk. I read that because, you know, he has this, they had all these cameo appearances in it. You know, they zoom in on him, "Truly this man was the Son of God." Wow. But compare Matthew and behold the curtain. Sometimes I want to give it a try. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook. And so that's the same as Mark's. And then the earth shook, and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. Whoa, that's a little different. Sort of like Night of the Living Dead. That's where we get the "He is risen indeed." Maybe "He is risen indeed." when the centurion, and then, but then, look, scene that changes scene four completely. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw what?
The
earthquake and what took place, they said, "Wow, this must be the Son of God." So it's a whole different thing, because why does the centurion in Mark say that?
Because the curtain was torn.
Well, did he see the curtain torn?
No.
The curtain, no, the temple curtain would have been inside. Probably the curtain between the Holy of Holies and besides, this is outside the wall. So that's there just for the reader's benefit. The idea of the curtain, this is obviously a very symbolic thing. If we were focusing on this passage as an end in itself, we would look at all that, but it's supposed to just be illustrative. So what did he see?
He sees the death.
Sees the death, nothing but the death. He sees Jesus die like any human being would die, crying out in agony, and he says, "Wow, this is the Son of God." So, I mean, again, we can unpack this, we can spend the whole week on the scene and unpacking each gospel. Maybe we should do that, huh? but the main point is that you can see from this scene that each of the gospel writers presents Jesus from a distinctive point of view, which is going to, of course, how is that going to affect our desire to get at Jesus' ethical teachings? What does that mean for us as we try to get at this first question?
We're
going to hear different teachings.
Mm-hmm. Gives us some choices.
Yeah, gives us some choices. Yeah. I mean, should we choose between one of these scenes? Yikes. Of course, now we're getting at, this is maybe why the church, you know, this is probably where we're reenacting the council meeting in which they decided to keep all four gospels. I can't choose. They're all good, but they're all very distinctive. So yeah, I mean, we're gonna see Jesus, for example, we're gonna see Jesus say in Mark, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, period. In Matthew, he's going to say, whoever divorces his wife and marries another, except for unchastity, that's a big except. I mean, there's either buts or there's either absolute, you know, it's unconditionally, it's wrong, or there's the support. And in Matthew, he says that, and Mark, he doesn't. Whoa. So we're going to, we've got to pay attention to the fact that the gospel writers are going to preserve different versions of Jesus' sayings, perhaps, and will have possibly shaped them in light of their own experience and in light of their own theology. So that's one of the challenges.
You also have the challenge of the different relationships of Jesus that you have, but different relationships of Jesus, the will of Jesus, and the will of God the Creator.
Right.
That can make for a vast difference in how one's going to find these things.
Right. I mean, in terms of how each gospel writer portrays Jesus,
yeah.
Relationship to God. Yeah, oh gosh, yeah, that's a huge thing. Let me show you another scene that brings us closer to, the choices here are, yes, we can choose one of these and say, I think Matthew's Jesus, as the most compelling ethic, right? Or we can try to synthesize. There is a synthesizing step here. When we see the different teachings in different places, our next step can be, well, let's try to pull them together and see if, even though there are some differences, there is some sort of coherent ethic that's, you know, maybe some underlying principles that provide a coherent ethic. So that may mean an additional step between the descriptive. Just to remind you, I had, what did Jesus teach? just an additional sort of a middle step between those two. We look at individual issues, and then we say, well, let's try to put them together, synthesize them. And of course, the other question, the major question, or a huge question is, are we going to go with, the canonical portrayal of Jesus, or are we going to use the canonical gospels to reconstruct a version of the historical figure, right? And is that going to be our main authority? Which did Jesus most probably say? That you can't divorce, or that you can if there's unchastity? Or a historian would ask, which is most likely to be the historical, closest to the historical truth among these four? So those are really our three choices. We can choose one gospel, we can try to synthesize the canonical gospels, or we can try to reconstruct the historical, what we think as the actual man Jesus, who came into Nazareth. This lesson is certainly so evocative in its earthiness, in its real, that Jesus was an actual human being. Is that going to be our...
Don't you have another choice there? With that
it's not in my notes.
That's because you missed it. But the very example that you gave about divorce, Johanna responds to the woman caught in adultery. The woman at the well and the woman caught in adultery. There's a different response. And so, as you said before, it's not just the words, it's how Jesus acts in the situation that could be as a...
There might be means of resolving apparent contradictions based on maybe there's enough of a principle that you can discern from his actions in the woman caught in adultery is another example. There's definitely going to be ways that qualify some of Jesus, I don't want to say there's an easy out for some of Jesus' radical statements, but we have to look at it in totality. I guess we can't do all of this, obviously, today, this week, even. if I can say next week, even. I want to give a sense of the complexity of the task and how easy it would be to hide behind this, like this. Let me give you another example here that's closer to our concerns more directly. One of the most interesting things, Jesus' most famous ethical discourse is what?
On
the Mount.
Illustrating here.
That begins with the Beatitudes. Matthew is the only one who has a Sermon on the Mount as a whole composition. Luke has a lot of the things that are in the Sermon on the Mount partially on what's sometimes called, I don't know, tongue-in-cheek, the Sermon on the Plain, because it's on, it literally says he was on a flat place in Luke 6. And he's got some a lot of parallel material, but then he takes some of that material too and puts it in other places in the gospel. But this is one of the most interesting and one of the most difficult decisions. Here's where I think we do have to make a decision about what Jesus was talking about. These are probably some of the most famous words in the New Testament. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Very familiar words, right? What does it say on the right? It says, blessed are you, or. It's supposed to be E. It's Eeyore.
blessed are you, Eeyore.
He's definitely poor in spirit, right? No, it's obviously supposed to be a P there. Blessed are you, poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. And then the parallel to verse whatever. Is this, could this be better for me? Is it really? Blessed are you that hunger now, for you shall be satisfied. Difference?
Yeah, hunger and thirst for righteousness.
Yeah, right. And blessed are you who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And what about the first one? What's the difference between poor and spirit and poor? What's
is he talking economics or spirit?
Yeah. This is another case where. Or this is probably one of the best cases where we realize, gosh, we're up against something here. Is Jesus talking about a spiritual disposition? Or is he talking about an economic issue? And then, of course, Luke has Jesus have the woes that make it even more explicit. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you that are full now, for you shall hunger. Woe to you that laugh now. That gets us to a pretty fundamental question that I think we do need to answer. It comes back to we do need to come to some sense of about Jesus. I don't remember who made the comment about the idea that Jesus had an agenda. It's not that Jesus doesn't have an agenda in that, but certainly one of the things that we have to recognize is that Jesus' words and deeds had a concrete historical place and time in which they were spoken. But
that's profound. You need a PhD for that.
But to work out the implications of that, the idea that Jesus actually was trying to shape present day reality. In other words, Jesus wasn't just after something spiritual. And I think you can bear that out in Matthew as well. I mean, you can't conclude from this that Jesus has only spiritual concerns in Matthew. But it is a distinctive emphasis of Luke that Jesus is especially concerned with the poor and the outcast, the physically poor and the outcast and those kinds of things. But one of the sort of the presuppositions that I want to work under is that Jesus actually was trying to enact a program. Now, whether that program involves particular political decisions, whether it involves what sort of shape that had is what we want to look at. That Jesus didn't just come to die on the cross. That's the idea. I mean, John 3:16, for all its beauty, makes it sound like what was needed was some sort of cosmic transaction, that God needed a death, the death of the Son, and that it could have happened any time, any place. Jesus could have gotten run over by a chariot. But the very fact that Jesus, this is what I was talking about, the cross is sort of the linchpin here, the very fact that Jesus was crucified on the cross, which was a political form of death. Jesus was executed by an empire and for doing something that threatened that empire. So there, in other words, that Jesus' death isn't just some sort of, as I said, cosmic transaction. It's also explicable in terms of, in historical terms. He was put to death, in other words, because of the way he lived. And we want to explore that that connection, so that Jesus so that there's a Jesus becomes real. Jesus becomes someone who was trying to enact a program, and what that program was, and again, what that program should have to do with us. questions, comments? I did have one other example, just again, very briefly. Just because this was the one I was talking about before with the rich young ruler. actually, this isn't the rich young ruler, this is the great command, but it's the same kind of thing. What I find, another sort of basic choice that we have to make, and I think you kind of already sense where I would like us to go anyway, is that what was the essence of Jesus' message? If you go by the Gospel of John, the essence of Jesus' message would be what? What should you do? Whoever believes in me. That's Jesus' main goal in John, is to get people to believe in him as the Son of God. Not the case at all, especially in Mark. But I don't think in any of the synoptic Gospels. When Jesus is asked to summarize what it means to be related to God, where does he turn in the first three Gospels? Not to himself, but look at Mark's. Which of the commandment is first? One interesting thing is, and one of the look at the difference in Mark and Matthew. One of the scribes came up and heard them disputing. This is when Jesus is talking in the temple. Came up to him and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he answered them well, asked him, which commandment is the first of all? Look at how Matthew. Again, this is another thing, another illustration of the fact that the gospel writers are really writing in terms of their own experience. Look at how Matthew casts the same scene. But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they came together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. A little different tone, isn't it? How would you describe the tone in Matthew?
More adversarial.
Yeah, much more adversarial. And in fact, the term came together. I don't know if you can tell actually something, but that's an allusion to Psalm 2. The enemies of the Lord's Messiah come together, and so it's sort of this is like an ultimate showdown here. And in Mark, what's so interesting is the scribe just wants to know what Jesus thinks, and in fact, they end up agreeing with each other and going off to have a cup of whatever. Turkish coffee, I guess, at the end. You are right, teacher, you have rightly said. But the main point is that when Jesus is asked to summarize, he says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. And the second is you shall love the neighbor as yourself." That's the essence of the faith. And of course, in that sense, you know, it's not surprising that a fellow Jew would agree with them. So one of the things that we have to think about is that the Jesus ethical program was not primarily based on getting people to believe in him, but getting people to understand the will of God in a particular way and shape their lives around that particular understanding of the will of God. We're going to see that at the head of it is this idea that God is, that one's primary allegiance needs to be to God, and that needs to shape the rest of your life.
At the end of Matthew's gospel, Jesus comes back around to that again, the Great Commission. Go make disciples of all nations, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. What did he command us? Or what did he teach us? To love.
Right, right. Exactly. And more specifically, in Matthew, what he teaches is to do the will of the Father. That's what's so interesting. Whoever says to me, Lord, Lord, this is the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount. Whoever says to me, Lord, Lord, but does not do the will of my Father in heaven, shall never enter. And the very last teaching in Matthew that Jesus has, the last public teaching, is the parable of the sheep and the goats, where people are judged how. Whether they fed them, fed the hungry, clothed the naked, and that kind of thing.
But wouldn't doing the will of the Father require faith and belief? I mean, so isn't that similar premise? Isn't belief, in order for me to do that, I have to believe.
But what's the content of your belief? What's the object of your faith? In that respect, I mean, is there only one option for that, or is there? I mean, does it have to be faith that Jesus is the Son of God, or can it be faith in the God that Jesus is talking about? You know what I mean?
Yes.
You don't have to have faith to do good things.
No.
You can just be philanthropic. An atheist.
Or do you want to fill it out a little bit or say more?
Well, I still think it would be belief that Jesus is who he says he is, and that he is attached to God and the will of God.
Yeah, I think, you know, that gets to a really central question. Is Jesus, the one that we're going to want to have in mind too, is Jesus' ethic worth paying attention to because he's the Son of God? That is to say, does he possess kind of a formal authority because he is the Son of God and therefore we should listen to him? Another, which is incomplete, I don't need to draw a false dichotomy here. This is a true dichotomy. No, it's a... I don't mean to suggest it's either or. The other possibility is that Jesus calls us to a way of living that literally does give life. And that's why people come to think of him as the Son of God. You know what I mean? There's kind of a difference there, I think. You think, or is that not a... Again, it's not something we have to choose, either or. I think it's helpful to think about the difference on why should we pay attention to what Jesus said? Because he's the Son of God, or because when you live out these principles, you achieve a healthier relationship to God and closer and to each other and to the created order.
It reminds me a little bit of my pediatrics professor who said, you know, there's a debate about whether you feed infants on a schedule or on demand. And he said, it doesn't matter because mothers all end up doing the same thing anyway. If you feed on a schedule, you know, one day the kid starts to cry and he's hungry and he drives you nuts and finally she gives in and she feeds him.
Right.
Right? And if you feed on demand, you know, one day she decides, I'm going to go to bed early and I'm feeding this kid. You know, and so it's like you can sort of, I think that's the point of the letter of John. One of his letters where he says, you know, show me your faith,
right,
and I'll show you my works. And
sure.
Through my
right.
works, I express my faith, and through your faith, you will express obedience and do the work.
Right.
I think that this question is so old, and the Gospels themselves show us how old it is. Why do we believe in Jesus? Why do we look at Jesus? Matthew starts by calling Jesus the son of Abraham and David. Mark, in some manuscripts, calls him the Son of God, and others not. Luke gives us an interesting story, and John starts with that great philosophical light-dark business, light and no light business. So even the relationship to God in the Gospel, in the Gospels themselves, when they start up, is very different as to why we should listen to them.
Yeah, and you know, and also I think, well, a gospel like Matthew especially, but I think it's probably true of all of them, and something again we'll want to come back to, is it's not just a question of why should we listen to him, but okay, let's say we've solved that question, well, how should we do these things? And there's where, you know, that's where, again, you get sort of a blending between the two, because I think it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly that without a discipling relationship with Jesus, you know, these kinds of ethical demands, this way of shaping one's life, it becomes really impossible. I think, you know, that's certainly the case for you know, for Matthew, who has these incredible demands, but also talks about Jesus as being, you know, with you to the end of the age. He talks about Jesus' yoke being easy and my burden is light, that kind of thing. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you want to see what's here? Oh, yeah, I forgot. Yeah. explain which Jesus, words. Maybe it's all summarized. But we're going to have to take that as it comes. You know, we're going to have to say, well, we're going to want to do some synthesizing. That's certainly by the end of the week, we're going to want to try and do some synthesizing. But just to touch on this for 1 minute, just to make our time to develop this part of it. But it seems like the main options here, what role should these play? I mean, option one is they should be the primary source of our ethic. I mean, this is Jesus, and what he said should shape what we do. That should be our primary source for our ethics. Option two is the one that, again, most Protestants are more familiar with. Jesus' commands, which are so difficult, are really meant, are really designed to do what? The Protestants, what are they designed to do?
Accuse.
Yeah, they're designed to accuse us and show us how far short we fall, and thus make us rely on what?
On faith, grace.
On God's, we you know, that's what we say. We are in bonds to sin, and we can't free ourselves. We can't do these things. I have not loved my neighbor as myself. I haven't, I did it again. What a surprise. But it's so that Jesus' commands really end up thrusting us onto God's mercy and provide, in that sense, a preliminary function to the gospel, of preparation for the gospel. That's kind of a classic Lutheran way of reading them. But then there is, of course, a third way, and that is that they provide a guide for sort of, maybe this is what Kurt said, for the life of faith, for one who has embraced Jesus and is now in a position, given the new birth through the Holy Spirit and through a discipling relationship with Jesus, in a different place in order. So this, I mean, the technical theological terms, I guess, would be called the third use of the law kind of debate, which is another old debate. But those are, I obviously don't have time to develop each of those, but I see those as kind of the principal options that have been exercised through, through history, with the second being the most prominent, as well as being the most problematic in many ways.
Jim, I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Do these three different normative options that you just described, are they three different ways of looking at the content of Jesus' ethics?
I don't think so. I mean, they might end up if they might end up with some different conclusions on the content. But these are more the ways in which what Jesus, the actual figure Jesus, taught. Options for how, what role they should play, which can help us see, well, should I you know, to what degree should I try to shape my life? Should I try to imitate Christ? But if the whole point is that I can't, and that God has known that and sent Jesus to die for me, then I'm going to be drawn towards different parts of the New Testament. Let's remember, of course, that the teachings of Jesus are just one portion of the New Testament and certainly the Christian tradition. And as surprising as it may seem, it's there, the idea that Jesus' teachings should be the primary shaping force in ethical decisions has not very often been the position of the church. It's probably some of the earliest communities of Jesus. When we go to the Anabaptist tradition or the Mennonite tradition, probably Leo Tolstoy played with that idea. But for the most part, they haven't been. They've been contextualized by the idea of Jesus' atoning death and resurrection, and thus in some ways have been relativized. That's why I think the second option is probably the most prevalent.
And even with our Muslim brothers and sisters, they can see the benefit of the ethics of Jesus and
right.
what he provides, and saying,
right.
yes, this is
right.
good teaching that we should model.
Right.
But like the scholar D. Dot, he says, show me in the scriptures where Jesus confesses that he's the Son of God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think that is a basic question. It's there for us.
Yep.
What was the first option?
First option is to take the teachings of Jesus as you know, as law, and try to live them out in much the same way I suppose that Israel tried to live out its covenant.
There's another way that sort of bridges, I think, that what you laid out as the normative Protestant view of this ethics as an accusation, basically, and conviction of sin. Luther has more to say than that we are sinners. You know?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And he reasons from the gospel rather than from the law.
Right. Right.
From the point of view of a person acting in loving response to God's generosity, then he can claim all of Jesus' ethical teachings as guides as well, only not so much as case law, but as examples of what loving behavior and Christ-like behavior is. And then you love and do what you will with these examples as kind of sort of guides, but not exactly as law.
Yeah, I mean, what the second position I gave is I would call kind of a caricature of Luther, and maybe more Lutheranism. I had planned to read just a little out of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, because he's one. I mean, he would say the same thing. And we read this, The Cost of Discipleship, a really challenging book. But he's the one who made famous the distinction between cheap grace and costly grace. And cheap grace is the idea that the forgiveness of sins becomes a principle. Like I was saying, that we kind of, I know this is going to happen every week, so what's the point of living any differently than anyone else? Because, and even he's got some great mock sort of sarcastic passages about how, you know, you might, you know, far be it from me to have the chutzpah to think that I could actually live out some of these things. So I've got to show, in fact, that God's grace is all sufficient by just living my life in absolutely no way that's distinctive from the rest of the culture. Because otherwise I'm betraying the idea that it's all from God's grace. And that for him is cheap grace. It's grace doled out, you know, without considering its cost, which was the life of God's Son. So there's definitely, Luther did not think you should sit on your haunches and let God do everything. That's complete. But that's the way it's been sort of developed, especially in popular piety. And it's definitely a danger of the preaching of grace alone, is that it can become a principle that justifies. He talks about the difference between justifying the sin and justifying the sinner. There's a huge that the gospel of grace justifies the sinner, puts the sinner in a right relationship with God, from which then can flow all these other things. Whereas we tend to use justification by faith as justifying sin, saying, well, I can do this because God's going to forgive me.
I'm wondering if there's another normative option, which...
I'm sure there is.
I suppose there are probably many, but I guess the one I'm wondering about is it possible to see Jesus as... relating directly to spirit as a being who accessed, whose decisions were made based on a personal, direct relationship with spirit, and that we could, in turn, not be looking at the content of his teachings,
sure. Yeah, right.
But as what he's saying to us is to relate directly to spirit and live from there, and the ethics will come from there.
And he would sort of be a bridge to that kind of existence too.
Well, he would be an example of living directly in relationship mm-hmm. to the divine. Mm-hmm. Isn't that what he did? I mean, he did that. He lived from there. He lived in that, and he trusted his direct relationship with spirit within himself. Mm-hmm. When he got troubled, he always seemed to take time out and get quiet, pray, to retreat, to whatever, to listen to that inner voice. Mm-hmm. And then he would do what made sense to him. Mm-hmm. And in some way, for me, that helps explain the contradictions that we see, because he wasn't about making hard rules about things, except perhaps for love, obviously, is one of the big ones, but he seemed so responsive to situations and to individual people. And it seemed like it all came from that strong spiritual connection that he had.
Boy, that's kind of a dangerous idea. Because obviously, you know, we would need some kind of, I mean, I wouldn't want to divorce that completely from the content, but I think the idea of it is definitely, because then Jesus is providing, and I would say too, at least that part of that could be that Jesus also provides an access point. It depends on, and rather than just an example, and also a means of the risen Jesus providing the means of a relationship to God that can give that sort of, and there certainly have been communities that have been, you know, again, sort of the more charismatic type communities that feel that they are able to connect directly with God and make base decisions on that. It's kind of a wild idea. But the thing is, there certainly are other normative options, but part of what happens when you study this, and I'm finding this, is that you, you can't necessarily make a prior decision about this, but studying what Jesus actually taught in the life that he called his followers to live can help you shape, you know, I can do that. and when we do it, or to say, this is too much. I can't, this is not a God of love. This is a God of demands that I can't keep. Or to show that the life of faith is a journey among those things. So hopefully, as we look at specific things, tomorrow we'll look at Jesus' program for social justice. Wednesday we'll look at Jesus' teachings on nonviolence. Thursday we'll look at Jesus' teachings on sexuality, marriage and divorce, and whether he had anything that might be useful in the current raging debate on homosexuality. And Friday we'll kind of try to do some of the synthesizing, or maybe pick up an issue or, you know, continue a discussion from the previous time. So that's kind of where we're heading. So thank you, and we'll see you as you wish. I mean, take seriously the idea that, you know, come as you feel moved. I won't be at all offended if you decide to take on any kind of music today. Thank you.